All right, I call this meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and the first order of business for today is approval of the minutes for March 27th, 2025. Co-Chair Swedzinski, do you have a motion?
Yes, Chair Kraft, yes. I move the minutes from March 27th, 2025. They're good. We looked them over, and they're excellent job, whoever put them together.
Fantastic. Co-Chair Swedzinski moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. And the motion prevails. The minutes are approved. So now we'll move to House File 2928. Chair Akam, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2928 be laid over for possible inclusion, and I also move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like it to be considered.
Fantastic. Chair Akam moves House File 2928 be laid over. For the A2, any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Nay. And with that, the motion is adopted. The amendment is adopted. Chair Akam, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2928 is a proactive and balanced approach to data center development in our state. In brief, the bill has three goals. First is to ensure environmental review to protect our natural resources. Second, it recognizes that the increase in energy demand as a result of data centers is happening at a time when we are working to increase energy efficiency. So the bill develops a community benefit program to help achieve that efficiency. And third, the bill includes a consumer protections provision to ensure that data centers will pay for the new generation and transmission their facilities require. And I want to be clear that I am not looking to prevent data centers from coming to our state. In fact, the potential for economic development is exciting, particularly for struggling communities across the state, including those in Representative Mecklen's district. However, we cannot deny the reality of the tremendous energy demand these facilities require. For example, take the Amazon project being worked on in Representative Mecklen's district. Their backup generation alone is 600 megawatts, which is equivalent to the entire city of Minneapolis generation. And that's just one data center. And we know there are many more being considered in our state. As I began working on this bill, I started by looking at what other states that already have a robust data center economy were doing to help determine what we should do here in Minnesota. The provisions in this bill are modeled after recent legislation from states like Indiana, Nevada, and even Texas. I also looked at Virginia, which could be looked at as the data center capital of the world. They had a joint legislative audit and review commission report that raised serious concerns about the impacts of data center development on infrastructure, resources, including increased energy demands, high water use, and questions about whether the industry's benefits are equitably distributed. In a new market like Minnesota, we can pass House File 2928 to ensure we do not experience those same challenges. Over the past several months, I have met with countless stakeholders, including utilities, data center representatives, and consumer protections advocates. I appreciate the conversations and have implemented many of their suggestions. This bill is being laid over, and I am committed to continue those discussions. So with that, Mr. Chair, and I know we're short on time, we've got a busy agenda today, I'd love to turn it over to testifiers, please.
Thank you very much. So first we have Annie Levinson-Falk. You can make your way, and then please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Annie Levinson-Falk, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, or CUB, a nonprofit advocate for Minnesota's energy consumers. I want to thank Chair Akam for her work on this bill, and particularly for accepting suggested language from CUB in order to protect electric ratepayers when utilities are integrating the new loads from super large data centers. This is contained in Section 10 of the author's amendment, and the amendment is titled Clean Energy Tariff, but in my read, this is primarily about ensuring that the costs and the risks from new data center customers are not shifted onto existing ratepayers. CUB has listened with cautious optimism about the potential benefits that data centers could bring to ratepayers in terms of reduced rates for everyone because of the additional electricity sales. However, if there are going to be ratepayer benefits, those benefits aren't going to be automatic. I've reviewed studies from places like Virginia that basically conclude while it's possible to serve data centers without shifting costs onto other ratepayers, doing that in practice is a very narrow needle to thread. And I've spoken with consumer advocates in other states with higher concentration of data centers who believe that the growth of data centers in those places has caused their residential electricity rates to go up substantially. This bill puts into law protections to ensure that households and businesses are not impacted by the growth of data centers on Minnesota's electric grids. The parameters in Section 10 are based on the well-accepted principle that utility system costs should be paid by the customers who cause them. What the actual cost to serve different types of customers is always a topic of vigorous debate in utility rate cases, and without being overly prescriptive, this section puts forth the considerations that must be undertaken to determine the cost of serving this new type of data center customer. Thank you, Chair Akam, for your hard work on this bill and for carrying this important policy forward. I appreciate the time to speak today and would be available later for any questions.
Thank you. Next, we have Sydney Lieb from Commerce. Make your way up. And following that, we have Katie Smith. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Sydney Lieb with the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Data centers can represent an important opportunity for economic development and growth in Minnesota. As Chair Akam mentions, this is not new or novel policy. We have seen similar policies across the country, specifically in Indiana, Nevada, and Ohio. These types of policies are standard operating procedures for data development in states in order to be responsible, to ensure that the potential risks to electric ratepayers and the environment are mitigated through these protective policies. The bill proposes and offers useful policies to protect the state's natural resources, maintain the state's progress and leadership on carbon-free energy generation, and deliver tangible benefits to Minnesota communities. Specifically, the support for energy conservation and weatherization has the potential to compound the public benefits and economic growth from data center development. In 2023, the state passed a law requiring electricity production to achieve zero emissions by 2040. The rapid load growth from data centers could significantly derail the state's monumental progress toward achieving this mandate and threaten Minnesota's leadership in the movement to increase investment in clean, homegrown energy without significant guardrails on this load growth. Section 8 of the bill ensures that data center energy use supports the state's progress towards reliance on carbon-free energy rather than creating barriers to this transition. Importantly, this section requires carbon-free energy tracking on an hourly basis, which supports the state's existing clean firm resources and promotes further economic investment in clean firm technology. On Section 10, if the public policy is designed correctly, data center load growth has the potential to put downward pressure on electric rates and benefit residential customers. This can only occur if the costs of grid upgrades and generation assets to serve these data centers are appropriately assigned to the cost causers. Section 10's clean transition tariff can help ensure that customers are protected from risk and uncertainties in data center development and energy use. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Katie Smith from DNR. Welcome to the committee. When you get set, please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Katie Smith, Director of the Ecological and Water Resources Division at Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for the opportunity to provide brief comments this afternoon. Water is not distributed equally across Minnesota. A project proposer may unknowingly choose a location with water availability or sustainability concerns. These concerns need to be considered early in the process of any water use project, especially before the design is complete, the site is selected, and land is acquired. The DNR is sometimes not aware of a potential water-intensive project until a permit application or amendment is submitted. Typically, this is a problematic time for all involved to learn there may be significant water supply challenges because adjustments to project design or challenges with project viability can be expensive and often impact project timelines. The DNR's experience has been that early coordination to discuss water availability in a proposed project location is helpful to avoid these situations and ensure project proposers are aware of any concerns or information needs. We believe the proposed language adds value for companies, communities, and the DNR. The DNR does have one potential concern with subdivision 5G regarding how we would be required to classify this information. We'd be glad to continue conversations with the author on that. Thanks for the opportunity to provide comments.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to move to public testimony. I've got a long list here, so we'll ask folks to keep it towards 2 minutes. First will be Chris Dufferin, followed by Zach Ruzicki. Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Chris Dufferin, President of Center for Energy and Environment. CEE conducts field research, implements programs, provides financing, and supports communities, businesses, and residents to save energy and money. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and thank you to Representative Acom for her leadership on this bill. CEE welcomes and supports data centers in Minnesota. As a state committed to clean energy, we have an opportunity to match new energy loads seeking clean resources with utilities providing clean energy resources. While additional energy sales can help our utilities pay for the infrastructure upgrades our system needs. At the same time, data centers present unique challenges. We have to balance energy supply with these significant demands, particularly during peak times, while maintaining affordability and reliability. Reducing heating and cooling loads through weatherization is an essential strategy in eliminating waste from the energy system during system peak periods. When we combine insulation with highly efficient dual-fuel air source heat pumps, we reduce customer costs and shift home heating toward electricity during shoulder seasons when we have abundant clean energy. Efficiency benefits households with lower bills, lower peaks that benefit the grid, and builds jobs for contractors throughout our state. This bill does not fund all the weatherization Minnesota needs, but by investing in those least able to afford it, the bill builds upon current programming funded by the Federal Department of Energy and ECO. Building on Minnesota's existing program delivery infrastructure, we can avoid redundancy but still allow the Department of Commerce to build capacity from qualified companies through an RFP process. According to our analysis, approximately 290,000 households with incomes of 80% area median or below still require weatherization, which at current pace will take approximately 130 years to complete. This bill can improve that pace and help customers statewide regardless of where they live and what fuel they heat their home with. For data centers, the funding mechanism provides certainty on what they would pay and an automatic exemption from ECO, saving time and money from the current process. In short, we think this provision provides economic, community, and utility system benefits while still encouraging new beneficial load here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you. Next, we have Zach Ruzicki, and then Zach will be followed by Ryan Henches. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Zach Ruzicki. I'm the Director of Resource Planning at Great River Energy, a Minnesota generation and transmission cooperative. We provide electric service at cost with all of our margins going back to the members that we serve. Although there are goals that we share with the spirit of this proposal, GRE believes that the current requirements are sufficient to meet the growth opportunities in this state in a sustainable manner. Our members may ultimately negotiate with and secure commitments to serve data centers in their service territory, and those members and their communities would experience financial benefits that would spread to many end users of their areas, including schools and other parts of the community. The proposed bill as it stands today would create some barriers to those beneficial outcomes for our membership. Namely, the implementation of an hourly matching standard in the proposal would be challenging and very likely expensive, with minimal, if any, benefits from a total carbon accounting perspective. GRE's commissioned study work on carbon governance on several different occasions in the past, including most recently in docket 23-151 in front of the Public Utilities Commission. Our work with Brattle Group examined the current body of research and also empirically studied jurisdictional developments around the country and found that hourly matching is simply not a superior regulatory mechanism to annual standard compliance, and in some cases can even lead to increased carbon emissions. If the utilities are required to incur greater costs for little to no additional reductions in carbon, those costs will be paid for by Minnesotans and by our members. But for what gain? Our member owners shouldn't pay higher costs for an hourly standard that will likely not decarbonize the sector any more effectively from a total emissions perspective than the standards we have in place now. The state of Minnesota already has an aggressive and nation-leading clean energy and carbon-free policy. The relevant regulatory authorities of the utilities that serve data centers today are appropriately placed to create programs, policies, tariffs, and other regulatory mechanisms that will allow these loads to be reliably and cost-effectively served within the framework of the standards that we have on the books today. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Michelle Benson. Wait a minute. Michelle,
I think Ryan was...
my apologies. I skipped over Ryan Henches, who's next. You're up after Ryan. First time doing this year, so.
You're doing great.
All right. Ryan, would you please introduce yourself and then proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ryan Henches, and I'm the CEO of Dakota Electric Association, located in Farmington. Dakota Electric is a not-for-profit electric cooperative that serves over 115,000 members across Dakota County. We are governed by a 12-member board of directors and are rate regulated by the Minnesota Public Utility Commission. Since June of 2023, we've been in conversations with various parties regarding data center development. We've received inquiries from multiple organizations totaling over 2,000 megawatts of electric service. Our system currently peaks at 500 megawatts. Although it's uncertain if all of the potential load will develop, we do expect significant growth over the next 10 years. As a utility, we believe if we can safely, reliably, and affordably serve a data center or any large load, it's our responsibility to do so. From an energy perspective, we believe existing statutes and regulatory environments already adequately balance the ability to innovate while protecting the consumers we serve. Minnesota's carbon-free by 2040 statute provides an existing framework for transitioning to carbon-free electricity. When talking with data centers, ensuring compliance with that law is part of our planning process, which they understand and support. House File 2928 appears to establish a new framework for carbon-free, which we see as unnecessary. Yesterday, Dakota Electric filed a modification to our commercial tariff with the Public Utility Commission. The proposed modifications achieve many of the goals in the proposed legislation and will allow Dakota Electric to protect the financial interests of both the cooperative and our member owners. For us, additional legislation on this issue seems redundant. As our economy continues to electrify, we expect low growth from data centers as well as other industries. We'll need to build additional generation to support this transition. Dakota Electric sees partnerships with these data centers as a way to build additional generation in a manner that doesn't burden existing members. Ensuring safe, reliable, and affordable power is the focus of our organization. We see partnerships with data centers as a means to continue fulfilling that promise of service. We believe existing state law and regulatory frameworks adequately protect our member owners, and we do not see the need for additional legislation focused solely on data centers. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, very wisely of me, I have Michelle Benson up there to go next. So Michelle, and then after Michelle is Dan DiOrio. So please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Akam, and Michelle Benson, Energy and Policy Committee, Energy and Commerce Policy Director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And on behalf of the 6,300 members of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, representing businesses and industries across the state, and over 500,000 employees, we respectfully oppose House File 2928. Innovation has been the hallmark of great Minnesota companies, and innovation is how our economy will grow in the decades to come. Prior to 2013, Minnesota GDP growth outpaced national GDP growth. But since 2013, we have lagged the country in GDP growth. In 2023, We ranked 40th, I'm sorry, of 50 states in GDP growth. Each of you received a copy of this report, and there are stats to back it up in that report. Additionally, in your packet, the Chamber shared our most recent scorecard on the status of permitting in Minnesota. Onerous permitting burdens, like those included in House File 2928, contribute to economic lag. Increasing regulatory burdens will slow the growth of data center investment in Minnesota. Technology advancement is accelerating, including edge computing, the Internet of Things, things we use every day and will continue to use into the future. Each of these advancements will require a data center platform. According to CRB reports, the direct job growth in data center industry helps create 7.4 ancillary jobs in average throughout the U.S. economy. As you know, across the country, data center property taxes have helped pay for local infrastructure, local schools, and lowered homeowner property taxes. House File 2928 will dampen these opportunities in Minnesota. The goals of House File 2928 to include the protection of resources are part of the conversation with data centers. Developers are already working diligently to reduce water usage via cooling towers and closed-loop systems. The industry has developed best practices for energy usage and even rates data centers on their power usage effectiveness, a PUE, for each data center. Businesses seeking data center partners are looking for these efficiencies and best practices. Consumers, as you know, are demanding care for the environment as part of product and service delivery, and the industry is responding to market demand. If House File 2928 becomes law, in addition to significant water and electric use permitting burdens, data centers would be required to pay additional costs, even though the state already has several funds dedicated to energy and climate purposes. Eventually, all of these costs will be passed on to consumers. Minnesota businesses and families have made it clear that costs matter to them and that costs in Minnesota are already too high. In conclusion, we believe that provisions in this bill will give data center investors a reason to look elsewhere. It will take the economic benefits, the jobs, and the tax relief with them. The investment will happen, just not in Minnesota. We respectfully request no action on the provisions of House File 2928. We thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Acum, and committee members for your consideration of these comments and concerns.
Thank you. Next, we have Dan DiOrio, followed by Kathy Johnson. And Dan is virtual, so go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan DiOrio for the Data Center Coalition. We are the National Association for the Data Center Industry, including leading data center owner-operators and large end users. We appreciate Representative Acum's leadership and desire for a balanced approach to sustainable data center development in Minnesota. Data centers are the essential digital infrastructure behind every online purchase, every telehealth appointment, every online news article, every digital classroom, and the essential services and cutting-edge technologies that drive the 21st century economy. Digital infrastructure is a critical component of the United States global economic competitiveness and keeping Minnesotans' data safe and secure domestically. Minnesota is an emerging data center market, and many of these provisions would introduce significant market friction and potentially create unworkable barriers to further data center development. The proposed energy and water reporting requirements are problematic from a trade secret, competitiveness, safety, and security standpoint. Data centers provide digital infrastructure for a range of essential services such as government, cybersecurity, hospitals, banking, finance, and others, many of which are necessary and critical, especially in times of emergency. They are repositories of vast amounts of sensitive information and support other critical infrastructure such as power grids, transportation systems, and healthcare. The disclosure of proprietary and sensitive operational details, including energy consumption, water consumption, and sourcing and other elements, can be used by business competitors to deduce trade secrets and inform competitive strategies, and also make facilities targets for bad actors and foreign adversaries looking to disrupt essential infrastructure. In Virginia, a similar measure was not advanced this year due to national security concerns. Similarly, the disclosure of information related to interconnection requests outside the state of Minnesota also raises serious proprietary and competitive business information concerns. Data centers develop by market and not on a project-specific basis. As such, there are no significant benefits to load forecasting or discouraging speculation from this provision. Data center developers are extremely hesitant for any utility to have competitive business information outside of their service area or jurisdiction. The data center industry is committed to paying its full cost of service for electricity. After nearly two decades of relatively flat electricity consumption in the U.S., we are experiencing projections of increased power usage driven by 21st century economic growth drivers. Aligned with sound rate-making principles, no customer, industry, or class should be singled out for differential or disparate rate treatment unless that approach is backed by verifiable cost-based reasoning. Any rate design that focuses on a single end use without showing a measurable difference in service requirements or cost responsibility creates unjustified distinctions among similar customers. Furthermore, for the states mentioned previously, all of those measures were introduced in the regulatory venue, which is the best venue to ensure that cost allocation and rate design are fair and reasonable for all customers. In particular, the Minnesota PUC can ensure appropriate cost allocation through public proceedings that are evidence-based, transparent, carefully considered, and open to stakeholder participation.
Mr. Diorio, if you could please wrap it up.
Thank you. Our members are committed to making meaningful impact through voluntary clean energy efforts. The data center industry is committed to being a collaborative stakeholder for sustainable data center development in Minnesota. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Next, we have Kathy Johnson, followed by Zach Martin. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, I'm Kathy Johnson. I'm from Farmington, Minnesota, and thank you, Representative Kraft and ACOM and committee, for allowing me to testify. I am testifying in support of Representative ACOM's bill as it attempts to establish much-needed guardrails for hyperscale data centers. I feel the bill has great merit in tightening the parameters by which hyperscalers can come into Minnesota and use our precious resources. I support the requirement that their water and power consumption be metered and become public record and that the DNR's water prioritization be enforced. Hiding data center water use by blending it with domestic water use disguises the actual water use and hides the serious offender at times of required conservation. I will say that I'm disappointed that there isn't more protection for residential communities where hyperscale data centers are pushing their inappropriate siting in residential neighborhoods and infringing upon environmentally fragile sites. In the absence of state guidelines, local governing units have widely varying regulations. For example, in Rosemont, Meta has a 1,500-foot setbacks to residential neighborhoods and 35-foot tall buildings. Compare that to Tract in Farmington, which has 250-foot setbacks to 50 and 80-foot tall buildings. What are we, the redheaded stepchildren? Aren't we Minnesotans? I've included in your packets a chart with more detail comparing Meta and Tract's disparities. As the chair of the Coalition for Responsible Data Center Development, I'm speaking for ordinary folks who've spent their lives building a community and now see young families wanting to move in and raise their families just as we did years ago. We need the legislature to protect us from the suggestion of financial gain and the absolute false promises of hundreds of permanent jobs, not allowing those notions to be used as leverage on our backs. We need protection in this David and Goliath situation. Hyperscale data centers are very heavy industrial projects by any stretch of the imagination and in no way belong in MUC zoning, MUCI, or near residential properties. We're not against data centers, but concerned about the siting. I ask the legislature for protection from behemoth projects being pushed on us in residential neighborhoods by predatory development. With the upcoming budget negotiations, as you seek to strike a balance between data centers and residents, please remember your constituents. Do not sacrifice the precious quality of life for Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Zach Martin, followed by Peter Wagenius. Please welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Zach Martin, and I'm the manager of government affairs for Elite Minnesota Power, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Power, Duluth-based investor-owned utility. First, I want to thank Chair Patty Akam for the continued collaboration on House File 2928 and appreciate the progress that has been made in this bill. I do think there is more work to be done here and look forward to those conversations. As you all know, there are several data center-related bills being considered this session. From our perspective, the overall goal is to create policy frameworks which encourage data center development in Minnesota and doing so in the right way. But to the bill, Section 8, for example, involves procuring carbon-free energy for data centers and reporting this out hourly. I just want to let folks know that last year during our rate case, when it was approved, Minnesota Power proposed a voluntary renewable energy tariff, which was approved by the PUC and is in use today, or ready for use. For a premium, these voluntary tariffs allow large power rate class customers to procure additional renewable energy above and beyond our current generation portfolio. This tariff is optional and not specific to a particular industry, which we believe is the right approach. On the merits for hourly reporting, we believe that the PUC is the right place to have those discussions. But I would like to mention why we want to attract data centers to our region. So think about it this way. If your district lies outside the 7-county metro, you know that attracting economic development projects and sourcing an adequate workforce is challenging. Most industries that are investing hundreds of millions of dollars are in manufacturing and require a substantial workforce working three shifts, which is difficult to secure in greater Minnesota. But large-scale data centers, on the other hand, provide the same hundreds of millions of dollars worth of investment, but require a more modest workforce for ongoing operations for a single facility. This fact improves greater Minnesota's opportunity to attract major investment, which will have real benefits for those communities. And by the way, if your district lies within the 7-county metro, the same economics argument applies. Hundreds of millions in investment and job creation improves the economic standing in any community. And I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Peter Wagenius, followed by George Shardlow. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Wagenius, Legislative Director for Sierra Club. If drinking water is polluted downstream of a data center in Minnesota, it won't matter to tech bros in Silicon Valley. If farmers in Minnesota can't use the water they needed for irrigate grading their crops because of water pollution or water depletion, it won't affect the stock price of Amazon, Google, Microsoft, or others. If our energy grid in Minnesota or our ability to reduce our emissions is damaged because of hyperscale data centers, Jeff Bezos and other tech billionaires aren't going to lose power at their mansions. They won't lose sleep over any of this because not only will they have already built their projects, they will have already cashed their subsidy checks from Minnesota taxpayers. Some will claim, unbelievably, that we can't make these tech giants protect our environment because it would be an imposition on businesses operating in the free market. There's no free market here. The tech companies are getting massive taxpayer subsidies, and unless this legislature takes action on this uncapped subsidy, Minnesota taxpayers will just pay more and more. We know that this year, education, healthcare, and other services will be cut $110 million deeper than needed to maintain the gravy train of corporate welfare. Voters will not forget this. Americans' anger over seeing their country handed over to billionaires of big tech is visible. It is growing. Whatever this legislature requires of these subsidy seekers is literally the least they can do. If Minnesotans are to be protected from these threats from hyperscale data centers, it will only be because legislators insisted on it through passing laws like House File 2928. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is George Shardlow. I serve as Executive Director of the Energy Sense Coalition, or ECC. ECC advocates on behalf of low and fixed income utility customers across the state. We would like to thank Chair Akam for bringing this legislation forward, that would seek to protect residential customers across the state through the advent of hyperscale users. ECC does not disapprove of the arrival of data centers to the state. And in fact, if regulated thoughtfully, the arrival of additional large customers could help pay for the already necessary grid investments needed for the clean energy transition. However, if regulated thoughtfully, is a weighty caveat. Utility service in Minnesota is governed by the Regulatory Compact, a set of corresponding rights and responsibilities. It's a system that knits us together by law as by copper. In furtherance of thoughtful regulation, House File 2928 contemplates the proper rights, responsibilities, and guardrails that should be assigned to data centers as they come online. ECC supports the provisions that would seek to hold residential ratepayers harmless, as well as the surcharge and corresponding weatherization funding that would ensure low-income communities see benefits through additional funding for weatherization. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions and comments, and I'm going to start with one. For Mr. DiIorio, if he's still available online. Mr. DiIorio, are you available?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So my question is, I understand your point that, well, I would say data centers use a lot of power and use a lot of water, and yet I think I'm hearing you saying it's not possible to actually ask you how much, that knowing how much is a trade secret. And my question there is, I don't really understand that, especially because within a data center, I think that would be important if you need to know, like, how many CPUs are there. But if you're not having to report how many CPUs are inside a data center, then why is it important why is it such a thing that you can't tell us how much water and power you use?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. I don't think it's a question of how much, you know, the data center industry would know how much energy is being consumed at the facility and how much water. The challenge becomes is that there are a variety of services within that data center. That data center can be providing that essential service, that essential infrastructure. That energy and water use, there's a lot of information that can be gleaned from that, and especially with regard to CPU use. Much of that in particular varies very much by data center company. Data center companies are not monolithic. There are a variety of sizes and business models out there. There are a variety of cooling technologies. Any information from that that is public that can be gleaned from that can be competitively, is competitively sensitive. In addition, there also is ongoing concerns, and those concerns were expressed by the Department of Homeland Security to a legislator in Virginia this past legislative session, that having the public disclosure of energy and water use puts a target on data centers back for foreign actors there, potentially bad actors that can look to disrupt essential infrastructure. So when it comes to the required public disclosure of this energy and water use by facility, that raises a lot of serious concerns for data center developers. And in particular, for those that are multi-tenants that are leasing out space for a tenant within their data center, that puts a lot of risk for those tenants. And there also is a necessary buffer between that data center operator and those tenants in terms of the information that's being processed on the servers in their facility. And so there's, given the proprietary information, the confidential information contained there, there needs to be necessary safeguards there in order to make sure that all that data is safe and secure. So those are the outlines of the concerns I think that we have most often with that, with the public disclosure reporting requirement. We have not seen any other similar measures passed in other states. And I believe oftentimes utilities and others can provide that number in the aggregate, which will help then, you know, not break it down and provide and won't raise as significant as security concerns as it would be by, with disclosure by facility.
Okay, thank you. Although I do see if there's going to be so many data centers in so many places. Cherry, did you have a comment?
Yeah. I do have a comment, and I appreciate what Mr. DiIorio was talking about with trade secret, and in my conversations with the data center groups here in Minnesota, this subject came up many times. And about water, even I was talking with Google, and they said that annual water reporting was certainly sufficient and wouldn't give the granular nature to provide any trade secret. And so I certainly appreciate the sensitive nature of the business and the work that these organizations do, and so want to be as sensitive as possible to that. Within our community benefit program in the bill, looked to have tiered energy demand instead of actual energy use, again, to provide that privacy to that data. So just wanted to point out that I appreciate the concern, and I hear the testifier's concern, and tried to incorporate it, and will continue to be open for more conversations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've got about 20 minutes for questions. We're going to be done by 2 o'clock. Next on the list, we have Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Madam Chair, I do have some questions, which I'm sure you're shocked by. In this, you have a thing for the PUC to track hourly usage, and maybe the utility companies, is this currently capable of being done, and if so, how are they doing it? How much does it cost to implement it, and how many FTEs will it require at the PUC?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Meckland. So this has been a topic of conversation in the last couple of days, and as I understand, and I'm not going to say I'm an expert, we do have some people here from the Department of Commerce who maybe could get in further, but as I understand it, it's an accounting mechanism, or how many hours and how many megawatts and how many hours and megawatts of renewables. So I think it can be quite simple, but I could be oversimplifying it as well. So if anyone would like to speak further to it, I think that that's possible. I know there were concerns in terms of the 100% hourly matching, and I recognize that that is a higher bar or a higher threshold than our benchmarks for 100% clean energy, and so therefore we removed that requirement with leaving just the 65%. So.
I see Cindy Lee from Commerce. Do you have some comments you'd like to add?
Thank you, Chair Kraft. Representative, the Minnesota Department of Commerce has looked at this extensively, as we believe this is the direction the state needs to move. We currently have an annual REC RPS requirement for utilities, so utilities are already familiar with generating a REC per megawatt hour of generation that is occurring on their systems as they generate renewable energy. And I expect that the level of carbon accounting to track and verify those RECs would not be different from what it would be for an hourly. The metric would be different, but the overall procedure should be the same. So it could use existing staff at PUC, existing staff within the utility. We do need our MRETS tracking system or some other tracking system to update their procedures so that they can generate those certificates and do the tracking, but it shouldn't be an unreasonably significant lift at the utility who already does annual REC tracking every time their system generates a megawatt hour of clean or renewable electricity. Furthermore, as far as how this is happening in other places, this is something that is beginning to bubble up in various places across the country. PJM on the East Coast is starting to generate these hourly certificates for their market system, for their interregional market. The hydrogen tax credits are currently in the guidance requiring hourly tracking of energy for hydrogen generation for the 45V tax credit at the federal level. And there's several large customers, Google being one of them, that is proposing to do 24/7 tracking for their energy use. And we're starting to see also 24/7 tariffs happen in other states and get implemented so that customers like Google can be ensured that they're buying 24/7 clean electricity. So this is very much a new and developing policy, but we believe the purpose of doing policymaking is to keep track with the current developments in the space and to continue to advance and maintain Minnesota's clean energy leadership.
Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was insightful. Thank you for that. Because every conversation I've had with all the companies previously mentioned, they all are very committed to buying renewable energy, but because the question comes into play beyond that. Last year, the Xcel had their IRP on energy, and they one of the things they asked for was to engage in power purchase agreements outside of MISO. How can you tell what power was generated, not knowing where it came from, to know whether or not it's renewable? Once it's mixed on the grid, is there a way to tell that, I guess, and that might go to one of the utilities as well.
Ms. Lieb?
Chair, Representative, I'm happy to begin to address that. So this is getting to the question, there's two types of power purchases. There's specified and unspecified sales. So if you're buying directly from a PPA that you have a contract with, that would be a specified purchase. And in that case, you would know where the energy was coming from, what the carbon intensity of that energy was. If you're buying an unspecified sale, then you do need to have this REC associated with the energy in order to ensure that it's carbon-free. And that's why when you buy energy, we have the REC system already to ensure that the megawatt hours are being tracked at an annual level. So this would just be increasing the level of granularity.
Representative Mecklen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more, because I know we have a limited time, and I'm assuming there's going to be more questions.
You're good.
On page 2 of your amendment, you have a fee scale here for 100, 250 megawatt, 2 million, 250, 500, 3 million, 500 megawatt or greater. Does this keep graduating up, or is this it? I mean, if it was 1,200 megawatt or 1,400 megawatt, would it keep escalating?
Madam Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And good question. What you see is what you get. So at the highest is $4 million for anything 500 megawatts or greater.
Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure there's other people who want to ask questions.
All right. Thank you. Next, we have Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing this bill. I'm really excited about, having this conversation. Something that was brought up or that made me think about a conversation we've had recently about energy assistance, and I think we had a bill about that, about wanting to put more money into it because we have a great need for weatherization, a great need for helping low-income folks pay their utility bills and keep folks warm and safe. So in hearing about, this bill would help provide weatherization services, how do you think this could impact our energy assistance needs?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jones, for the question. I think that that's a really important aspect of this, and that's why we chose to make it targeting low-income Minnesotans. We have seen and heard, and we recognize the importance of providing assistance to those who need it. And when we're putting such a large energy load, like data centers, on our system, at a time when we're really trying to build energy efficiency into everything, I think it only makes sense that we have a fund that will be able to help those within our community achieve that. And so it's really recognizing the challenges that our low-income Minnesotans face, especially the energy burdened among us. And so I think that's really, I would love to be able to quantify, like it will cut the, I think Mr. Dufferin talked about, 100 years at the current rate. Would this cut it in half? I don't know. I don't have, and we don't know how many data centers will actually come. But I think that we included this understanding the need for this work, and this would be another way we can help achieve that.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, no, I think that it makes a lot of sense to me that we're being proactive as opposed to just paying utility bills. We're helping to just make sure that those utility bills aren't as high in the first place. So I absolutely love that. One other piece that I just want to mention, given the testimony from the testifier online, he kept referencing essential infrastructure, and I just want to be careful about us calling data centers essential infrastructure. I think, we as humans, we need water to drink, clean water, we need clean air. Those are essential things, and we need infrastructure for those. And that, yes, we do have tech, and we have a lot of need for those, but those are not essential. And I want us to be very careful when we're using phrasing like that. Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Akam, for bringing this forward. Yay, more data center. conversations. I know we're all excited. I was wondering if Ms. Benson from the chamber could answer a couple of questions.
Ms. Benson, would you return to the testifying stand? So we have Michelle Benson, and you can go ahead and ask your question, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you had some pretty passionate testimony, and I'm interested to know why you think this bill will drive out data centers. It seems like protecting residents and small businesses and clean water resources and the grid is pretty common sense. And as Chair Akam mentioned, this bill is based on things that have been done in other states, including red states, right? Like Texas, Utah, Indiana, and they're still investing there. So I'm wondering why you are so certain that this will drive out the data centers.
Ms. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins, I appreciate the opportunity. Indiana and Texas take different approaches to their overall regulatory structure. And as I included in your packets, Minnesota's permitting is actually lagging what would be considered ideal. And I understand there's some language in this bill that's going to be heard on Thursday in the Committee of Jurisdiction and Environment, and so we'll be prepared to have comments as related to that specific permitting. Minnesota does treasure and protect clean water. It's very important. We have significant regulatory structures in place, and so adding an additional regulatory structure without viewing where we currently are in regulation, I think, leads us down a path of piling on instead of saying, are we sufficient? So the question should be, do we have sufficient regulation to do the protection that is necessary, or have we found a new area and we just want to grab onto it? And so let's have an environmental conversation with the relevant committees of jurisdiction about what is sufficient. And when it comes to large users, the PUC has jurisdiction over large users. That can be brought to that jurisdiction. But I think right now the question should be, do the structures we have in place meet the necessary protections that Minnesotans have valued, or are we going further? And again, we have permits that are hundreds of days overdue, and even our regulatory agencies will acknowledge that. And so before we add more, let's make sure we're looking at what's already in place.
Madam Chair, you have a comment?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Benson. I wanted to just comment on the sufficient regulation that we currently have, as described by yourself and a couple other testifiers. And I just want to point out and remind people that in this bill, we are exempting data centers from ECO. And so we are preventing them from having to pay the charge on their energy use that other energy users have. Now, some industrial users have been exempt from that, but let's not forget, all of them have not. Flint Hills has not been exempt, the University of Minnesota. So there is no guarantee that data centers would be exempt from the existing statutory structure. And so just want to remind people of what that existing statutory structure is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hollins?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins, I think that's a very informative conversation. What does the structure already look like? Do we have enough information to add another layer or to exempt someone? And so I think those conversations, part of which will happen in Energy Committee on Thursday, and in
Environment Committee,
I misspoke. Thank you for the correction.
Okay. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the answer. That's helpful. And I would like to continue that conversation. I guess the thing that I keep coming back to, and I totally understand your perspective representing the chamber, which is businesses, but businesses don't exist in a vacuum. And making sure we have clean water, making sure that people can pay their electric bills, making sure that human beings can function in the state of Minnesota is one of the great things about living in Minnesota, and we want all those people to stay here so that they continue working at those businesses and enjoying those businesses. And what I see this bill is doing is trying to protect some of those things that we care most about that make Minnesotans want to live and stay in Minnesota. And so I do thank you for bringing the bill forward so that we can continue this conversation. I do think it's an important one to have. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, I'm
going to
move
Chair,
to...
Mr. Chair, if I may be excused.
Oh, yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're keeping you here.
I'm going to turn it over to Chair Akin for her closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion today. I would like to see Minnesota be a state where data centers invest and do it in a way that protects our water, maintains our priority to achieve 100% clean, carbon-free energy by 2040, and ensures the current ratepayers are not left bearing the cost of new infrastructure and generation needed to serve these large data centers. With that, I thank you for the opportunity. And please know that my door is open, and I want to continue to have these conversations with folks who continue to have concerns. So thank you.
Okay. With that, House File 2928, as amended, is laid over.
All right. Welcome to committee, represent or chair her. I move that House File 2912 be laid over. Yeah. Thank you. And Representative Herr, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, chairs and members. Thank you for hearing House File 2912. This is a bill that seeks to have a direct appropriation of $2.6 million or $2.5 million from RDA for McAllister College to implement an innovative aquifer-based geothermal system that will be the first urban college campus in Minnesota and the second to convert from fossil fuels to geothermal energy. Unfortunately, Carleton was the first, and it beat us to it. By integrating geothermal technology with solar arrays and high-performance building design, this project serves as a living laboratory to showcase comprehensive energy solutions working in tandem. McAllister has already committed over $2 million to this project and is requesting $3 million in congressionally directed spending from Senator Smith and Senator Klobuchar, along with other grants. The project will house 224 students and return 224 housing units to the local rental market and serve as a direct heating cooling plant that will eventually eliminate carbon emissions for the entire North Campus and link to future twin geothermal systems on McAllister's South Campus. Madam Chair, I do have experts here today, but we thought that in the interest of time, since this is a pretty simple bill, they can just be here to answer questions and maybe if they're here, if they can come up and sit with me, and then we could just open it up to member questions on the bill.
Great. As I'm looking around to members, I don't know if I'm seeing any questions. And so maybe because I'm not seeing any questions, can we have the presenters take just a minute and tell us a little bit more about it, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to share a little bit more about this project. Building a sustainable future for Minnesota requires innovative solutions from communities around the state, and McAllister College is committed to leading this vital work. Through significant investments in conservation efforts, equipment and systems upgrades, and renewable energy initiatives, including on-campus solar arrays and community solar garden partnerships, McAllister has demonstrated its dedication to environmental stewardship. To achieve full carbon neutrality and serve as a model for urban campuses across Minnesota, the college must now transition away from natural gas-powered boilers for campus heating. The path to carbon neutrality at McAllister will unfold in the series of projects that Representative Herr so kindly explained, with the north side of campus coming first, linking to the south side of campus. And we will construct a new building on the northwest corner of Grand Avenue and McAllister Street intersection. Building will be five stories plus a basement, housing 224 students. as Representative Herr indicated, freeing up market housing in the neighborhood. Lastly, I'll just add the carbon reduction will deliver a carbon neutral building in this urban environment, and the building will be at least 40% more efficient than current code, saving approximately 1,300 kilowatts annually and up to $175,000. Immediate jobs creation will generate economic impact through construction jobs during development, and housing market relief will be demonstrated through bringing those students back onto campus. As Representative Herr indicated also, it features a modular scalability that allows for expansion into the neighborhood and the South Campus over time. This district energy potential can transform from a single building solution into a potential district-wide network. As Representative Herr also indicated, the campus is underway with a capital campaign, and so this is just one part of a series of infrastructure projects for the campus.
Thank you for that, I didn't mean to interrupt. Continue if you were finishing, my apologies.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and my colleague Nathan has a few of the budgetary elements of the project to share.
Please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Nathan Leaf. I'm the AVP of Facilities Services with McAllister College. Thank you for having us today. Just to expand a little bit on this system, this is a deep aquifer-based geothermal system. It is going to allow our campus to heat and cool this new building with 100% geothermal generated heating and cooling. This is not possible with traditional geothermal systems. It allows us with a tiny footprint to put these wells in and do what would otherwise require many acres of traditional geothermal piping. So this is an innovative project. It is something that will be extremely meaningful to our campus and to the surrounding community as a demonstration of how you do this in a campus setting with a limited amount of acreage to do it on. The building will be roughly 40% more efficient than code requires. We believe it'll save about 1.2 million kilowatt hours per year. And that translates to somewhere between $150,000 and $190,000 a year with a payback, we believe, of about 20 years. We're hoping it'll actually be a little bit better than that, but that's what the energy modeling is currently showing. Thank you.
Thank you. And it looks like we have a question from Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Herr, for bringing this. I have a question for your testifiers. Noting the timeline that you have here and the little thing you gave us in our packet, construction is going to be coming up here fairly soon in 2026, and I'm wondering kind of what happens if this funding isn't secured, and is this project something that can go in after the building is built? Can you help me understand that?
The testifiers.
It has to go in prior to the building being built, actually. So our intent is to start drilling these wells this fall. We need to clear the site because it's such a small building site that we're working with. We have to get these wells in the ground before we actually have the building start coming out of the ground. So if we do not receive these funds, we will have to pursue other measures, including fundraising or borrowing money.
Representative Jones, any follow-up? Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this forward. You already know I'm supportive of it. I guess I had a couple of questions. So first of all, I wanted to say good job on doing it before building the building, because it's so much more expensive to retrofit things after the fact. And then I had questions around and I know we talked a little bit about this, but is there any interest in pursuing funding from the Green Bank or MNCIFA? And if anybody had looked into it further.
The testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hollins. We have looked into MNCIFA, and we are planning to apply. And we also have, as I mentioned, our capital campaign underway. Our $2 million that we've already raised and dedicated to this project was a variety of grants and individual donations. A lot of folks that would be interested in geothermal have already given gifts, and so we would have to extend deeper into our donor base to create funding for this, but we are very committed to this project.
Representative Hollins, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That's good to know. And then do you expect that this will impact tuition for any students, maybe 20 years down the line when it recoups the cost?
So we've talked with our thank you, Representative Hollins and Madam Chair. We have been in touch regularly with our admissions, and this will provide a cost savings for students, especially those immediately who are living off campus, because it is about 15% less expensive to live on campus than off campus. And so those students coming back to campus will have an immediate savings, and then over the long run will create savings that will be applied to our overall costs for attending McAllister.
Great. Any follow-up, Representative Hollins?
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
All right. Representative Swazinski. Chair Swazinski.
Thank you, Chair Akam. Just a quick question. It was to the testifiers. I didn't get your name, but you had mentioned it's going to be a 20-year payback. Is that with the state, if the state were to give you money, or is that without the state, or is that just the project in general? What did you kind of mean by that statement?
To the testifier.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, we believe that that is with the solar, the extremely efficient building, and the geothermal all combined, that by investing in that package, we will see a return of about 20 years.
Representative Swazinski, any follow-up?
Thank you. That's it.
Representative Sexton. Oh, thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. My question, I guess, is the CDS funding for a private entity. Have you received CDS funding in the past?
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. We have not. However, the St. Thomas Microgrid project was a private project most recently, and ours is pretty similar in terms of we're a private college located in the urban area looking to request funds from RDA, and we find that with where we are located geographically in the XL zone and the intended purpose and spirit of the RDA, we feel that we meet and qualify for approaching for funding.
Representative Sexton, any follow-up?
I think there might be some confusion on the funding. I asked about the CDS funding, the congressionally designated.
Oh, please excuse me, Representative. This project was included in Senator Smith's congressionally directed spending bill last year, although it didn't happen because of circumstances, and so she has agreed to support this project again this year, as well as Senator Klobuchar. Thank you for repeating it.
Before I turn it over for closing comments, I just want to thank you for bringing the bill forward. And I do think that there are multiple benefits that you are looking to achieve here, not only in doing the right thing in terms of energy and the environment, but also bringing students back on campus and freeing that housing up in the community. So I thank you for that, and I turn it over for closing remarks to hold your closing comments, Representative Jones.
Sorry, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Akam. I forgot to mention the piece around how excited I am to hear a 40% energy reduction from base code. That's a big deal, and I just want to state that on the record that is amazing, and we'd love to see more and more of these types of things happen.
Now for your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Akam and Co-Chair Swazinski and members. We appreciate the opportunity to come in front of all of you. I think, Chair Akam, you actually summarized what I was going to say, that I think that when we look at solutions, we should look at it from the intersection of the ways in which we live our lives. And this is not just about doing the right things for the environment, But this is about a university being really thoughtful about the example that they are setting and being a leader in this work as well. But also, if you're familiar with my district, and this is right in the middle of my district, is that we have very dense housing. And to be able to free up 224 units so that in a very high demand area is actually really big for my district. And so from many perspectives, this is a really great bill. And we can be the leader in how this is done in a small urban area, a small footprint area that is in an urban setting. And just like St. Thomas's microgrid now is the place in which people come to test and to use that facility, we can also be the example of how you can do this in really tough, limited environment. And so thank you all for your support. I hope that this bill gets included in your bill at the end of session. Thank you.
With that, House File 2912 is laid over. Next on our agenda, we have House File 2928 with 2986. I can't read my own writing. With Representative Kraft, who's making his way to the table. Okay. And so, Representative Kraft, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I am pretty excited to be presenting this bill to the committee. It's based on a pretty simple concept. When a utility needs more power to satisfy a peak demand time, from an electron's perspective, it makes no difference whether the utility generates or purchases that amount of power or is able to have customers reduce or shift their demand for the same amount of power. Many utilities have been doing a version of this for a while, with demand response programs for businesses or programs for consumers that allow them to control your HVAC unit for short periods of time. The difference now is that with increasing amounts of distributed energy generation and storage, and increasing amounts of devices that can control and shift their energy usage, think EVs, heat pumps, heat pump water heaters, smart thermostats, smart panels, and more, there is an opportunity to do a lot more of this kind of a thing. So this is what virtual power plants are. According to a Department of Energy 2025 report, virtual power plants are solutions that can be deployed at scale in a short time frame to maximize the use and value of existing grid infrastructure, minimize costs to ratepayers, and ensure a resilient, reliable, and secure grid for all Americans. Estimates are that virtual power plants could provide 10 to 20% of peak load annually by 2030, which would save $10 to $20 billion in annual grid costs across the country. So, on to the bill. And I will tell you, even though the concept is simple, there is a decent amount of complexity to figuring out policy approach and implementing VPPs. This language is a starting point based on a lot of research and a lot of conversations, but I know there is still some work to be done to finalize it. But there's such potential here. So the bill requires IOUs to have 10% of their peak load satisfied by a virtual power plant over the next several years. There are ongoing discussions about this percentage. The reason I picked it is that it has been used in other states and syncs with the nationwide goals I mentioned previously. There's been some feedback I've gotten that we may want to have it reflect a new percentage if there already is existing load served by demand response. Another key point to this bill is that it gives the Public Utilities Commission the ability to provide an off-ramp if the targets provide too difficult to achieve, very similar to what we did in the 2040 law. Would require that this VPP, virtual power plant information, would be reported as part of the integrated resource planning process, which already happens for utilities, to build into that. And then specifically, the bill would have investor-owned utilities create a tariff that would define how they'll work with third-party virtual power plant providers or aggregators. It talks about the goals for such a tariff and then gives ideas and suggestions of what can be included in the tariff but leaves it to the PUC to work out the details with the IOUs. It also, as one would expect, creates some reporting requirements. So with that, I know there's several testifiers, and I'll turn it over to them.
Great, thank you. First on the list, we have Sydney Lieb with Department of Commerce. So we'll have her make her way up. And I'm also going to ask Patty O'Keefe with Vote Solar to join her at the table so she's ready. And next will be Jim Pearson. So when you, we've got about 15 minutes to get through testifiers. So I would ask people to be as concise as they can. With that, go ahead, Assistant Commissioner Lieb.
Thank you, Chair Akam. BPPs aggregate and manage distributed generation, storage, and demand response so that these distributed resources function like a grid-scale generation resource. As we've just discussed, Minnesota is anticipating significant load growth in electricity demand, at least partially driven by a data center development in the state. We have a significant challenge in meeting this energy demand for these large customers. Because we need to bring these generation resources online at the pace of data center development and demand growth. We anticipate that supply chain constraints in grid-scale generators and delays with the MISO interconnection queue are going to create challenges in increasing this generation. For example, the MISO interconnection queue, a project may wait 12 to 18 months just to receive an interconnection agreement. In that amount of time, a data center can be almost close to being fully built and online. Virtual power plants are an important tool that can rapidly increase generation available on our grid by making use of new and existing distributed generation, storage, and demand response. Utilizing these distributed systems in this way circumvents both the supply constraints and the interconnection queue delays. The Department of Commerce supports an all-of-the-above approach to achieving the state's 0x40 clean electricity requirement. And this all of the above includes virtual power plants. As we continue to invest in our power grid to serve a growing electric load, transmission investment is a driver of increased costs to ratepayers. Virtual power plants can provide low-cost, clean, firm power by utilizing existing generation, storage, and demand response resources on the distribution system located in and near large population centers and electric loads, evading the need for transmission investment, which is currently driving up rates. For this reason, VPPs can be an important source of low-cost energy. Our utilities and policymakers are already considering the value of VPPs as a generation asset for Minnesotans. Our Public Utilities Commission recently approved a large utility-owned virtual power plant as part of a department-negotiated settlement on Xcel's resource plan. The approval of the VPP in Xcel's resource plan is a good first step towards increasing deployment of VPPs in Minnesota, but we believe that the potential to deploy these assets in the state is larger than this single project. Utilities will testify here today to concerns regarding cost impacts to ratepayers from VPPs and the uncertainty around how these projects may impact rates. These statements should be viewed with significant skepticism. It is much more likely that VPPs can provide lower cost energy compared to large-scale utility resources. Vertically integrated investor-owned utilities are incentivized to build transmission and generation infrastructure and prefer these investments over alternative investments such as VPPs. They can avoid expensive transmission build-out. Given the misalignment of incentives that favor large system investments over distribution system investments and non-wires alternatives, utilities will underinvest in VPPs without a policy signal to make these investments, such as the policy proposed here. This bill would encourage further development of the virtual power plant ecosystem in Minnesota to benefit all of us through lower energy bills and increased reliability and resilience. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to Ms. O'Keefe and James Pearson. Join us at the table too, please. Go ahead, Ms. O'Keefe.
All right. Hello, Chair Akam, Chair Szczesinski, and members of the committee and Representative Kraft. My name is Patty O'Keefe. I am the Midwest Regional Director with Vote Solar, an organization advocating for equitable solar policy. I want to thank Representative Kraft for bringing this bill on virtual power plants, which are an exciting new technology that can help us do clean energy smarter and more efficiently. When I first was learning about virtual power plants, I got confused. Like, it is like a little bit of a wonky concept, and so this analogy that I learned early on
really helped me conceptualize it, so I'm just going to share that in case it's helpful. You can think of a virtual power plant like a beehive. So a beehive is made up of thousands of individual worker bees, which each contribute to the strength and productivity of the hive. In the same way, a VPP is made up of many small energy resources like rooftop solar, home batteries, electric vehicles, and smart appliances that work together to provide reliable and flexible power. And just like worker bees adjust their activity depending on the needs of the hive, VPPs can respond dynamically to energy demand. When the grid needs more power, rooftop solar and batteries can send extra energy. When demand is low, EVs and smart appliances can store or shift energy to balance the system. At the center of it all, the hive acts as a control center, coordinating the efforts of thousands of bees. Similarly, a VPP uses smart technology to aggregate and manage all these distributed energy resources, directing them in real time to strengthen the grid. And just like a hive is stronger and more resilient because of its decentralized structure, rather than relying on one big power source, VPPs can make the grid more reliable by tapping into many distributed resources instead of just depending on a large single power plant. Which I know we'll have some of those too, but just want to say we're very excited about this technology. We think that this bill is a good start. However, to fully realize the benefits of VPPs, we think it's really important to ensure that third-party aggregators can participate fairly and that the program is designed to maximize competition and consumer benefits. Right now, we have some concerns about the bill allowing the utilities to serve both as program administrators and aggregators. We think that that could potentially be a potential conflict of interest or could limit competition. So we think that there need to be some really important guardrails, or we could risk a system where utilities primarily enroll their own resources rather than creating an open and competitive marketplace that allows for independent aggregators to bring in more customers and innovation. Again, are very happy this conversation is happening and look forward to more conversations with Representative Kraft and other stakeholders on program design. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. O'Keefe. Next, we're going to turn to James Pearson and would ask that David Moberg make his way to the table. Go ahead, Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to be here in front of the committee today. We wanted to start by acknowledging the work that Representative Kraft has put into the bill, and we also appreciate his engagement with us as the bill is being developed. So that is always much appreciated. I just wanted to share kind of three top line concerns and discussion points that we're having with Representative Kraft. The first one is essentially we're asking to crawl before we run. As Dr. Lieb mentioned in our last integrated resource plan that was recently approved, we are in the process of developing a distributed capacity procurement program, very similar to a VPP by another name perhaps. But that is a very detailed process. We are in the midst of developing that proposal. That proposal is due this fall to the Public Utilities Commission. And I think one of the things that we are really focusing in on is to try to get it right. We need to know things about siting. We need to know things about technology. We need to be able to test some of these things on some smaller scale to ensure that it works. If we don't get it right out of the gate, then we're going to set ourselves back as we move forward. So again, we're asking for some patience and the opportunity to develop this proposal, as we're the first utility in the state to go down this path. A second item that we are in conversations around is some of the language on page 4 and 5 of the bill. As Representative Kraft explained, there's a fair amount of detail there. And one of the things that we would like to bring into that conversation is a more conversation or more focused on cost effectiveness criteria. When we evaluate some of these different approaches, whether it's on the generation side or whether it's on the demand side, management side, we want to make sure we're doing things that are cost effective. I think that's one of the key components of our SIP programs, is they're always evaluated under that lens. And lastly, we're having conversations about a new market entry. As third-party aggregators come into Minnesota, we want to understand, are they regulated? If so, how? Are there consumer protection issues that we need to be talking about as the bill moves forward? So again, appreciate all the work that's going into it. We appreciate the willingness to have further conversation and for the opportunity to share that with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Mr. Moberg, and on deck will be Joe Hoppe. Go ahead, Mr. Moberg.
Good afternoon, Chair Akam, Chair Swidzinski, committee members, and Representative Kraft. My name is David Moberg. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association, or MINSIA, our over 170 member organizations and their 5,000 Minnesota employees throughout the Minnesota clean energy economy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill, and to Representative Kraft, both for bringing this bill forwards and for being so willing to engage with the many stakeholders. We fully support the spirit behind this bill, and we wish to see a successful virtual power plant program here in Minnesota. As we've heard many times throughout this committee this session, including earlier today, dramatic load growth is coming to Minnesota, and virtual power plants can be a very effective tool in our toolbox in order to help meet that load growth. Every tool is needed both to meet our 2040 goals and to meet load growth, and there's space for a wide variety of technologies and avenues within the VPP umbrella. We do have a few key recommendations and concerns for the current language that we would like to see addressed, and we are committed to working both with Representative Kraft and stakeholders in the short, medium, and long term in order to address those. In respect of this committee's time, I will highlight a few of the recommendations and letters submitted to this committee. We share many of the thoughts and recommendations of the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum, Clear Coalition, Good Leap, and others that were submitted on this bill. A couple highlights. We have concerns about the public utilities being able to serve as aggregators without adequate guardrails. As the Conservative Energy Forum highlights, that could create information and access asymmetries, as well as create an uneven playing field, and really kneecaps the ability of the market to drive down costs via competition. Additionally, as GoodLeap notes, we would like to see discussion of the avoiding a possible cost recovery double dip where a public utility can both be an aggregator and get a rate of return on assets within the program, as well as updating the definition of aggregator to ensure that third-party ownership can be properly regulated but also participate in order to enable market competition. Thank you for your time. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Moberg. We're going to go to Joe Hoppe, and then on deck is going to be Shannon Anderson, who I think is virtual. Go ahead, Mr. Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, sorry. Madam Chair and members, I'm Joe Hoppe with Otter Tail Power. Otter Tail Power is one of the smallest investor-owned utilities in the nation. We generate, transmit, and distribute electricity to approximately 133,000 customers in 422 communities across 70,000 miles in Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota. With due respect to the committee and the committee members and Representative Kraft especially, we feel that this legislation is unnecessary, at least at this time. Virtual power plant technologies are already considered in IRPs, usually by order of the Public Utilities Commission. Otter Tail Power already has approximately 25% of our peak load being met with demand response, and we have soon to be implemented technology that will boost that number further. In everything we at Otter Tail do to serve our customers, we always think about reliability and affordability. We are worried that this legislation will increase our costs, the cost to our customers, for something that we are already doing. So while we appreciate Representative Kraft, as always, and his efforts, respectfully, we're hoping that the committee chooses not to put this in the omnibus or the omnibus bill this year. Thank you.
And to be clear, Mr. Hoppe, this is just an informational hearing, so I appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the correction.
Next testifier is Shannon Anderson online. Go ahead and unmute yourself, introduce yourself, and go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. My name is Shannon Anderson. I'm testifying on behalf of Solar United Neighbors Action. Unfortunately, our Minnesota State Director, Bobby King, is on vacation this week, so we appreciate the opportunity to testify remotely today. As Sun's Distributed Power Plant Policy Director, I'm pleased to offer these comments on behalf of the over 8,500 Sun supporters across Minnesota. We appreciate Vice Chair Kraft's leadership in advancing innovative solutions to Minnesota's energy needs, such as virtual power plants or VPPs. Our supporters across the state are excited about the opportunity VPPs bring to save utility customers money, create grid reliability benefits, and foster economic development in our communities. Since VPPs cost 40 to 60% less than other energy supply resources, VPPs can help keep energy affordable for all Minnesotans. For these reasons, we are very supportive of enabling legislation for VPPs in Minnesota. In the interest of time, I won't repeat the comments of previous testifiers, but note we support the comments and suggestions made by Vote Solar and the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We remain optimistic that a legislative solution is within reach to best leverage the investment and innovation of customers and the private sector companies that serve them to create a more affordable and reliable electric grid. And we appreciate your time and consideration of these issues and look forward to further discussion. So thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. And our last testifier is Michael Overend. Also virtual, please unmute yourself, introduce yourself, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is my volume okay?
It is. Thank you.
Thank you again, and thank you, Chair Switzinski, Representative Kraft, and committee members. I'm Mike Overend. I'm testifying from Two Harbors, where my wife and I invested in our home's major energy efficiency remodel, plus home solar for a better clean energy future. Even with the 30% federal tax credit, it will take 18 years for our solar to pay for itself, now made longer by our cooperative's new grid access fee. Participating in virtual power plants incentivizes important investments in distributed energy resources with an additional revenue stream. I am very grateful for Representative Kraft's bill supporting Minnesota's solar, battery, and smart appliance businesses. It is wise policy providing both utilities and their customers with major savings for reliable clean energy to meet peak demands while reducing needs for new peaker power plant and distribution grid infrastructure. Beneficial electrification is rapidly increasing peak energy demands and challenging Minnesota's important 2040 goal for 100% clean electricity. A significant cost to utilities and electric consumers to meet this goal comes from providing reliable generation during brief peak energy demands, primarily with fossil fuel peaker power plants. Minnesota lost $22.7 billion importing fossil fuels to power 73% of our economy in 2024. That's 1.5 times our funding for K-12 education. Instead, we should invest this money in Minnesota's clean energy economy, including support for distributed energy resources with important revenue that can come from new virtual power plants and adequate net metering rates. The U.S. Department of Energy projects these immediately dispatchable energy resources can be rapidly scaled by 2030, meeting up to 20% of peak energy demands, saving consumers up to $20 billion annually, and increasing grid reliability, resilience, and security while lowering greenhouse gas emissions.
And I need you to wrap up, Mr. Overend.
A state tax credit on new home solar and storage, net metering, and virtual power plant revenues is wise, too. I'd love to be one of the bees in the hive. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Overend. And I think I remember meeting you at the Clean Energy Economy Minnesota event earlier this session, and I think you asked a question about virtual power plants. So I'm glad to see that you are here testifying today. And with that, Representative Kraft, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. Given time today, we're going to not be able to get to questions, but I hope that members will reach out and learn more about this work that you're doing, and I appreciate the forward thinking that you're putting into it. So thank you for that. Our last bill on the agenda today, I think I saw Representative Myers make his way into the room. Welcome to committee, Representative Myers. I'm going to go ahead and move that House File 2297 be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture. And I think that there's an amendment, so I'll also go ahead and move the A1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like to consider. So any discussion on the A1, members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. With that, Representative, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I first want to say thank you to staff, especially Mike. He's been very good with communicating with me, so I really appreciate it. So, members, before you, House File 2297 is a bipartisan effort to expand the innovative and environmental responsible use of agrivoltaics in Minnesota and to finance the successful but underfunded Board of Soil and Water Resource Solar Pollinator Habitat Program. House File 2297 proposes a voluntary and dedicated funding mechanism, kind of a first in the country license plate, featuring a solar facility, grazing animals, honeybee hives, and wildlife. We do have artwork for a little.
Oh, it's in front.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Right, making sure everybody can see that.
You so. Just can't see it. We can.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah. So, created by Replace Studios. They're also the people that created the logo for the Minnesota State Fair, Johnny Pops, and this was commissioned by the Natural Resource Service of Sauk Rapids from employees contributing to it. As well as Bear Honey. So I thought they did a pretty good job, and you could maybe see the chair's last name on that maybe. So as this committee is aware, solar projects have expanded throughout the state, but how do we best protect farmland? Testifiers today will speak to how solar facility design for stacked benefit and dual uses result in more options for agricultural production plus pollinator habitats. So I don't know who wants to go first.
And with that, we'll turn. It looks like you've got some testifiers. Sarah Webby with Mincia. Go ahead, introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Chair Acomb and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Webby. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association to talk about agrivoltaics today. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you, Chair Acomb, for supporting this bipartisan effort. Agrivoltaics is the practice of combining solar energy production with agricultural production on the same land. This can include growing crops, raising and grazing livestock, or cultivating pollinator habitats underneath and between rows of solar panels. Adopting this definition into Minnesota law will enable the state to quantify and encourage the benefits of habitat and agriculture-friendly solar site management practices. We are enthusiastic about this bill because it creates an opportunity for solar energy to support rural Minnesota's agriculture economy by encouraging dual land use and stacked economic benefits. Solar developers will need to partner with agricultural specialists to perform the agricultural elements of a project, which would create new and additional economic opportunities for farmers and others in rural communities. The potential benefits could be substantial. In conclusion, I urge you to support House File 2297 to continue Minnesota's leadership in innovative land use that benefits our environment, our agricultural communities, and our clean energy future.
Thank you. Next on the list, we have Lindsay Bryce with Audubon. Please go ahead, introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Lindsay Bryce. I serve as the Director of Policy for the National Audubon Society's Upper Mississippi River Region, which is Minnesota, Iowa, and Missouri, but we are based right here in Minnesota and have a long history in Minnesota. For over 120 years, the National Audubon Society's work has focused on habitat conservation. So some of you might be surprised to hear that we've also set ambitious goals around supporting the deployment of 100 gigawatts of renewable energy and electric transmission on the grid by 2028. So that's why we're here having this conversation today. We come to this work by following our science, which concludes that decarbonizing our economy is good for birds and, by extension, our agriculture, our ecosystems, and our communities. Overall, we work with energy developers and policymakers, and we are focused on solutions that avoid, minimize, offset, and monitor impacts on birds. While the build-out of renewables such as solar it has some negative impacts on birds, those problems are solvable. So as Minnesota works to implement ambitious clean energy goals, it's critical to implement as many multi-benefit strategies as are available. This bill consists of two parts. I'm not going to talk about the agrivoltaics portion other than to say that Audubon Society supports that as well. I want to talk more about the portion that relates to the license plate that you see right in front of you. That program, the Habitat Friendly Solar Program, is a cost-effective, successful program. There's been some research showing that it increases biodiversity on those sites. There's actually a letter in your packet, and I want to note that there's one additional signer that didn't make it onto that letter. It was the St. Croix Oak Savannah chapter of Wild Ones. Should also be on that letter. This program, proven to increase biodiversity, does not currently have a dedicated funding stream. And we know that we're going to see more and more solar projects and across the state, and we're concerned that the program is not going to have the funding to keep up. The license plate enables you to have the first license plate with solar panels on it in the country, as far as we're aware. If somebody has seen a different one, let me know. But as far as I know, there's grazers on that. There's grazers and pollinators and plants and all sorts of things on it. You have beef sticks that I think were just passed around. Those are from Audubon Conservation Ranching Certified Farms that do some similar work in implementing conservation strategies to the benefit of both grassland burns and farms. So we support both portions of this bill, and would urge you to do the same.
Thank you, Ms. Bryce. And our last testifier is Colleen Hollinger, who's virtual. Please go ahead and unmute yourself and proceed. If you could be brief, please, we're running out of time.
Yep, I'll come in under 2 minutes. Thank you, Chair, and ACOM and Chair Skwazinski. I'm Colleen Hollinger, Director at Natural Resource Services. We are a thriving native restoration business in central Minnesota, and I live in Representative DeMuth's district. Our company has restored thousands of acres of short stature native prairie under solar arrays, and we're very successful thanks to that habitat-friendly solar bill that was established in 2016 that Lindsay from Audubon just mentioned. Few other pieces of legislation have accomplished as much to restore native prairie in Minnesota as that 2016 bill, creating habitat for songbirds, game birds, monarchs, and native insects, really all across the state, but paid for by solar developers. The solar habitat bill has grown to be great for businesses and agriculture, as we now use sheep grazing for efficient site management. In 2016, our Board of Water, Soil, and Resources was designated without oversight funding for this program. They were designated as oversight in the program, but without assigning any ongoing general funding. This HF 2297 remedies this lack of funding by providing that voluntary opt-in specialty license plate. And it'll be ongoing funding for Bowser, so we're not coming back in 3 or 10 years for other funding on a general fund. Why do we need another specialty plate when there's so many out there? Really, because the solar will continue to grow in Minnesota, and Bowser will struggle to keep up with site monitoring without adequate ongoing financial support. This threatens to degrade this highly respected quality of this program. And this license plate takes the burden off of the general fund and instead provides the voluntary user source funding that's been discussed. And there are thousands of us in Minnesota who will voluntarily pay for the plate fee to support the Bowser program, because the beautiful plate, as you can see, promotes pollinator habitat, songbirds, and agrivoltaics. So I would encourage you to support this bipartisan pro-business, pro-agriculture, and pro-pollinator HF 2297. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm looking around the room just to see if a brief comment. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll make it very quick. Representative Myers, I support your bill. I've seen an example of this at the West Central Research and Outreach Center in Morris. A herd of cattle grazing in amongst a stand of solar panels on a higher post, which I think is necessary, but support your bill, and thank you.
Thank you. Any closing, actually before closing comments by the bill author, I want to share that some on the committee think maybe you should make the plates out of recycled solar panels. So that was a suggestion made by, so anyway. Anyway, any closing comments to
just
the author?
With time, I would just ask everybody to support this so we can move on to ag.
Great. With that, I renew the motion that House File 2297, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and your bill is on your way. Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.